Yeah, it's good to be back with y'all again. Thank you for having me again. It's a real honor to be here. My name's Brian. I teach at several places now, and that's okay. I can barely remember all the places that I run back and forth between the times. Teach at Wesleyan School just down the road now. Just recently, this last summer, we finally moved. We've been coming here about 4 years, finally moved down to the area, so we love being 8 minutes from church instead of 45, which is what we were last time. So, but it's great to be here with you. My wife, Morgan, is a nurse at CHOA, so she's in the NICU. If you ever have folks running in and out of the NICU, she loves to check in on them if people from the church are there. She's at the Eggleston campus, which is soon to be the big Arthur Blank hospital that they're building. Have y'all seen they're going to transfer everybody in a single day? Anybody who's interested in logistics, it's like, it's fascinating to me. They're transferring everybody. It's a single day in September, October. They all got an email recently saying no one gets to get this day off because it's the one day that's a Sunday, and they're going to move everyone on in one day, which I thought is just amazing. But she's there. She constantly amazes me. I remember when I was doing my PhD, I'd come home and I'd be like, I saw an original like manuscript from the 1500s and was able to touch it. She's like, I revived a baby that died today back to life. And I was like, oh, she always beats me on the cool stories. So my oldest daughter is at Georgia State, finishing up there. She's going to be a child life specialist is what she's working toward. My middle daughter, Parker, is at UGA. So we had an interesting week. This week, her car was parked. She got interviewed by police. She was actually just one of those thankful moments for God. She was planning to go run on the same trail, for those of y'all who know the story, that morning, and she overslept. So she came home Friday and just was, yeah, pretty torn up, and we were too. She's on her way to wanting to be a doctor, which will be kind of fun to see if she does this. She'll be the first doctor that's a medical doctor, I think, in my family. So I'm a doctor, but not the type that can save your life. We can just talk about why, you know, you might, you know, why our bodies fail and stuff like that. That's what I'm good at. And then my youngest, Taylor, he's at Wesleyan School, which is where I also teach during the days. I teach Latin there. And Taylor is in eighth grade and getting bigger and like what you would expect from eighth grader. He loves video games and laughing with his friends and jokes that might not be very polite. And we have to remind him that that's not very polite because middle school boys are just, they kind of go insane for a couple years, I think, before they become human again. And I think I remember going through this. I don't know if y'all remember your middle school years, but it's different. But I have a wonderful family. And anyway, so it's great to be here with y'all today, and I'm excited. So we're going to continue the study of Nehemiah today. Ed was a little dangerous because he said, do whatever you want. And I was like, oh, okay. So as I went through here, this is what we ended up with. That used to say Nehemiah 3 and 4, and notice it now just says Nehemiah 3. And we're going to get to it. But to continue the tradition from Ed, it might take us a while to get there. So we're going to go there. But Ed has done a fantastic job. The weeks I haven't been able to be here, I've been listening online, and it's just been great. He's a great teacher. So I'll try to do my best in his stead. And hopefully today will produce a positive result for you in either one of two ways. One, you'll enjoy the change of pace. Or two, you'll be really excited when Ed's back next week. So, you know, hopefully that'll be good one way or the other. So let's begin with a review before we get up to Nehemiah 3. And let's kind of quickly review where we've been so far with the study. So, did this turn off? Oh, see, this is one of those things that was working when I left the stage earlier. Let's see if it will come back for us now. Come on, little guy. Yeah, this technology is supposed to make our lives easier. And it does in many ways. Sometimes, thank you. Yeah, no, that's perfect. Sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. Well, we have lost connectivity, I believe. So I'm going to have to just kind of walk back and forth and do that. There we go. So our context, okay, so a few things just to remind ourselves of. I'm a historical theologian by trade, so I love history and I love context and how it relates to everything. But I'm also not just a historian, but I'm a theologian, so I also love literary context and the context of the text itself. So So most, if not all, of Nehemiah is written by Nehemiah. Scholars are kind of divided on that. So we're reading most, if not all, again, of a first-person account written by Nehemiah. So that's easy enough. Okay. Probably later put together with the book of Ezra. Ezra and Nehemiah really are meant to be read together. And in fact, for in certain parts of the Jewish tradition, it was, and I think still is, written, done as a single book. Let's see here, slide two. I might have to walk back and forth a good deal now. Alrighty. So scholars are divided over the precise date, so I took a few and just chose one for us so that we can focus in, because ancient dates, dating is so difficult. And, you know, I deal with, my specialization's on Augustine of Hippo, so I do around 354 to 430, which is AD. So I do about 800 years after what might have been Nehemiah. It's hard enough to date stuff in the 400s AD. It's really hard to date stuff in BC. But H.G.M. Williamson, who I've used, he used to be a professor over at Cambridge, who's written an Ezra and Nehemiah commentary. He made a pretty good argument I read for it being probably between 430 and Artaxerxes' death in 424 being the end of the work based on Nehemiah 13:6 and what's there. Oh, by the way, I'm going to reference a lot of verses, so pull your Bible out, or as my friend says, or turn your Bible on, whichever you need to do if you want to be able to verse check me on things or maybe read some of the context I might be mentioning as we go through there. I like slides, but I'm not the best slide creator, and I'm also not, I don't believe in creating slides for everything. I just, you know, and I just can't. So I won't have slides of every verse I mentioned, but we will have some that we'll focus on. All right. So anyways, that's when he says it could have been earlier. It could have been in the 450s. It could have been a little later than that. But we'll just go with this 430 to 424 so that we have something we can put our head around, because that seems like the most likely date. And this is the problem with history, right? Is we want history to be a science, but it's an art. And you're like, well, from everything that survived, the best we can do is guess that we think that this is the date. And this is what I could find might be about the best timing we have. So we'll trust Williamson on this. We'll kind of go with him from there. But as I mentioned, I'm a historical theologian. So naturally, I wonder what else is going on in the world around this time. And so so God's leading Nehemiah to rebuild walls. And what else is happening? Now, if you're like me, is anybody like me with that? Anybody else just always wondering, like, what else is happening in the world at this time? Okay, well, you're in luck, the five of you that raised your hand. The rest of you, just hang on with this for a minute, and then just, you know, we'll just smile at us, and we won't think we're so weird. But anyways, so what's happening? By the way, this is not in chronological order. Some of this is just stuff that happened to be happening over about 500 years, but is happening at this time. So let's go here. Anybody been to Athens? Yeah, okay, the Parthenon. You know the Parthenon? It was a temple. It was also the city treasury, right? The Parthenon. Anybody been to the British Museum? The British Museum's fantastic because when archaeology was invented, Britain was the empire, right, that covered most of the places. So they have all the stuff from everywhere at the British Museum. They have all the reliefs that are supposed to go around this. Remember, do you know the story about they created copies of them and send them to Greece, and Greece refuses to put them up because they want the originals back. So if you've been to the British Museum, you've seen the reliefs that went around it. This is the Parthenon, but it was built around the sea. In front of there is Latin for circa. It's related to the word circle in English. It means around. That's what a sea means in front of anything. So around 432. So around this time, the Parthenon's being constructed. What else is happening around this time? Well, around 427, Plato is born. Also around this time, anybody know who Plato's teacher was? And Plato's student was? Aristotle, yes. His teacher was Socrates, his student was Aristotle. I like Plato better than Aristotle if you have to read ancient philosophy, so I was joking. Plato was a wrestler, that Plato could have beat up Aristotle. So I'm not sure that really proves anything. I just, whenever my students and I are talking, that's my argument for why Plato is better. Plato's born around 427, so he's just a baby, of course, so he's not really doing anything at this point. But Socrates, at this point, his teacher, has already risen to power. Like, not power, that's really the wrong way of saying it, but prominence. So much so that in 423-ish, he will be satirized in Aristophanes' play Clouds. Has anyone else read Clouds? Had I not done my PhD, Augustine, I would never have read it. Has anyone read Anthony Doerr's All the Light We Cannot See? Has anyone read Anthony Doerr's newer book, Cloud Cuckoo Land? Okay, Clouds is the book that inspired Cloud Cuckoo Land that they keep talking about. It's the inspired thing of the fictional text that they keep reading that's ancient. So if you read Cloud Cuckoo Land, you might want to read that. Anyways, so this is all happening around this time. So Socrates is running around. I don't think he's a hoplite anymore. What else is happening? Well, around maybe, this is something that's really much harder to date, might have around 424 here in Sarnath, northeast India. Anybody been to Sarnath? I'm probably saying it wrong. I'm really bad when you get me out of Indo-European languages. So in Sarnath, Siddhartha Gautama, do you know who people mostly know him as? The Buddha, yeah, is preaching his first sermon on the Eightfold Path, possibly around 424. Again, some of these dates, ancient history is difficult to know exactly when. Siddhartha was a Nepali prince who was disgruntled. He was experiencing what the French call ennui. Anyone know what ennui is? This is such a fun word. It's boredom from having too much, right? Yeah, boredom, maybe, you know, disgruntledness with life because you have so much. It's what we experience when we turn on Netflix or Disney Plus, and you're like, there's nothing on. And you're like, there's 10,000 things there. But, of course, there's nothing to find to watch. And I know what that's like. Alrighty, so from 475 to 221, so that was India. Here's China. China is on the front end of what's called its Warring States period, which will end with the end of the, and I had to look up how to pronounce this, the Zhou Dynasty, which is spelled Z-H-O-U, the Zhou Dynasty. And not long after this end of this period, the Han Dynasty, which most of us have probably at least heard in passing, will rise. So we're at the end of, we're in this Warring States period in China. Alrighty, where else? Let's see here. Oh, Amartyas of Sais is about two decades away from kicking the Persians out. So I gave us a map here of the Achaemenid, which is the Persian Empire, in the 6th and 5th century BC. You can see that Egypt there is included in it. He will kick Egypt out and set up. I couldn't find a single depiction of him, or I would have put it up there instead of a map. So you get a map. There you go. So he is at the end of... He kicks out the Persians. Oh, I wrote this better than I could say it off the top of my head. I was like, he will soon end the first Persian occupation of Egypt. He'll become pharaoh, and he will serve as the only pharaoh in Egypt's 28th dynasty. Anyone know how long Egypt's 28th dynasty lasted? 5 years. Is the 28th? I'm not sure why they would call that a dynasty if it was only 5 years. Doesn't a dynasty need time? I don't know who creates the definition of what gets to be a dynasty and what doesn't, but it lasted 5 years. Persia, by the way, within about 60 years after that, would be back and own Egypt again. Nigeria, Nok culture would be in full swing in Nigeria. Nok culture is known for its terracotta. It's a terracotta statue. So this is a man, a terracotta figure of a man. They're not quite sure when to date it, but it could be as early as 500 BC. You can see all the detail there and everything going on there. So this concludes our quick trip around the world. Just for those of us who like to see what else is happening, other things are happening around the world. And so it's always interesting, I think, when you think about God's providence. I saw you're going to do the R.C. Sproul series soon. When you think about God's providence, about why did God choose this one people group over here to do this at this one time? And I think it's a fair question. I also think we'll never get an answer. Well, we'll never get an answer to it while we're here. Or we'll never fully understand it. We might have insights into it, but we won't fully understand it. The response sometimes is just, I don't know why, but he did. So let's work with that. So as we work with that, let's switch back to Nehemiah. So Nehemiah's work might have ended between 430 and 424. He is cupbearer to the king. As Ed noted, this position presented constant possibility of death, and I think we need to remember that. It's just he's constantly that's constantly there. I don't know if he's like us with driving or flying, where, like, you know, somebody could run into my car, but I don't think about that anymore every day. I might have when I first started driving, but now I don't. You know, where you become immune might be the wrong word, but you just don't think about it anymore. Or if it was a constant thing he thought about, it'd be interesting when we ask him when we see him in heaven, like, so Nehemiah, what was that like? This cupbearer position also gave him access to the king. And this is something interesting I read from an Old Testament scholar. Interestingly, according to Russell L. Meek, M-E-E-K, Nehemiah was also, because of the way that the Persian Empire was at the time, quote, likely a eunuch, given his service as Artaxerxes' cupbearer. Now, if so, this makes it doubly interesting because he would have not only been forbidden from entering the temple because he was a layman, he would have been forbidden to enter the temple because he was also a eunuch, because both were not allowed to do so. And so it also would have put him in an interesting position socially when people are threatening him and such. Now, do we know? No, we don't know. But this is it's a possibility just based on how things work there. So again, that's why he says likely a eunuch, but you know, you can't say for sure. All right. Another thing I think we just need to keep in mind as we go, will there be a test on this? There might. I don't know. So just letting you know. He's cupbearer. Okay, so months of prayer. Now, if we remember in chapter one opens up with Nehemiah, and we get his, he hears the words, right, in chapter 1, verse 3, that the remnant there, in the province, and he means Jerusalem by this, who had survived the exile, is in great trouble and shame. This is the report he heard. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are destroyed by fire. And so we get this prayer in chapter 1, but we have to remember that this prayer represents not just a single prayer. This prayer represents his petition to God over several months. A lifestyle of prayer. It's a summary of what he had been praying and what his continual petition to God had been over those months. It's not like Nehemiah just goes, I heard the news, I'm praying, now I'm going to the king. And I think we have to remember that because if you study America's history, for instance, we have a very, especially evangelical, which is what several of us might consider ourselves to be, there's a very activist impulse that we all have. We hear the news, we fix the news. Does that make sense? We hear it, we fix it, we hear it, we fix it. But Nehemiah doesn't do that. Nehemiah's example for us is he hears it, he absorbs it, he prays for several months about it before action is taken. And Ed mentioned that to us, and I think that's good just to continually draw ourselves back to you because I share the American, especially the American evangelical impulse, which is like, I need to, what do I do? Like, that's my immediate response. What do I do? And I've noticed this as a father. I don't know if y'all noticed as you were, I wasn't this way necessarily, but then as a dad, my whole life started becoming about how do I fix this as fast as possible so I can move on to the next thing. And I think it's good that I do that to help my family. It's also not good because there are moments where we can't fix things and we just need to sit with our children or sit with our spouse and just say, I'm sorry, and cry with them. And there's times we need to at least process it with them before we do anything about it. And so I think I can be very unhealthy at times when I'm doing that. I can be very unhealthy by trying to rush on to fix things rather than to be with the people that I'm going through it with. So Augustine does that. Ed reminded us of that, and I think that's something else we want to remember. I am behind on my slides, aren't I? Oh, no. No, I'm not. Never mind. We're still here. Okay. Just checking. La 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 la. Where were we at? Here we are. Okay. Sorry, y'all. This is my first time ever. So I saw Ed do this, and I was like, maybe I could use an iPad to do this from also. Usually I have paper with me. So bear with me, and at the end, if you're like, that was awful, just say, like, that was awful. You need to go back to the paper, and I will. So, no, really, I'm from the West, so you weren't hurt my feelings. Like I just value, like, the honesty and the, you know, thank you. I appreciate that. Although I do say y'all now. Travis, I heard you say y'all earlier. Where'd Travis go? Yeah. Are you from the South? Or you are? Okay, I'm a transplant, but y'all is such a nice one-syllable second-person plural pronoun. It's so good. And I remember when I first moved to North Carolina, I was running Young Life area, and I kept calling everyone you guys, and the ladies came up, and they were like, we are not guys. And I was like, oh, no, no, no. In the West, guys means just, I guess it means y'all. So then I had to switch to y'all. So that was kind of what transferred me over there. Okay, so we're moving on here. We got months of prayer. So we got his petition of God over, to God over several months. So just remembering here that if we're to use Nehemiah as an example, and it doesn't mean that everything should be used as an example in the Bible, right? And that's something we have to be careful of. David and Bathsheba, that's not a good example, right? So just because it's written in the Bible doesn't mean it's good and we should do it. But if we're using Nehemiah as an example here, his first response is not action but prayer. And I think it's good for us to remember that. So, alrighty. The king, as I already mentioned here, is probably Artaxerxes I. And as we discussed a few weeks ago with Ed, Artaxerxes probably did not have pure, godly motivations or motives behind letting Nehemiah return. It was funny. I that was a week I missed, and I heard Ed on the podcast. And I saw him after that, and I said, oh, I wish I could have been there for that. So with Augustine interprets Paul on providence and how God's providence uses free will and God's will still gets its way in the midst of human free will. This is what happens all the time. And so it shouldn't shock us that the king is probably letting him go. Maybe, I don't know, if the city walls get rebuilt, maybe Nehemiah can bring some more capital his way by getting a stronger economy going there with a more stable system. And he's probably thinking, I have some money. Or maybe he's thinking, if they'll rebuild the walls for free, then we can station my garrison there, right? Like, who doesn't want something for free? That sounds fantastic. So there's a myriad of things, and of course, we don't, as far as I remember in Nehemiah, have it written down why he does that, but he does, and it's probably not because he's like, you know what? The people of God need to have the walls rebuilt, and the temple, now Ezra's been back to kind of reestablish the temple worship and kind of, you know, reform it to what it should be, kind of. And now Nehemiah needs to go back and do this so that God can be honored. Glory to God. No, he's probably not doing that at all. He's probably just doing what he wants, right, for certain reasons. Augustine has a great story. Has anybody read Confessions? It's something, it's like outside of the Bible, it's like one of the top three books in the Western tradition that tends to be read. It's often read by college freshmen for some class. I've probably read it 25 times now, and every time I get so much more out of it. It's a brilliant book because it has so many levels to it. Augustine's one of those people, like, imagine you had Einstein and imagine Einstein could talk like Shakespeare or could write like Shakespeare. Augustine is one of those once in a 500 years brains where with theology, he's just amazing, and he also can write well because most theologians don't. Similar to most philosophers, similar to most scientists, I guess I would say too. And so it's brilliant, but he has this one point where he is recounting his life before he is a Christian, and he is in Rome, and he is ambitious, and he's a very good public speaker, very good. And so he wants what at the time would be a kind of a professorate. You can't really describe it that way, but Rome just has a different system. And the best place for him to go is in Milan, Italy, because at the time the imperial seat is there. The emperor's living there. The court is there. It gives you access to power there. You'd be well known. You'd get lots of people that would keep giving you things, right, and access to other things, governorships and such. And he makes this decision. He wants to get to Rome, or to Milan from Rome. And he gets to go, and he is going for ambition. That is it. Right? And he has this line where he says, you know, I'm going there for all the things I can get, but you, oh God, you are sending me to Ambrose. There's two things going on there. So who's Ambrose? Ambrose was the bishop in Milan that Augustine would eventually go to his church and hear him speak, because as the professor of rhetoric in Milan, you should probably go hear who possibly the best speaker is in all of Milan, so you know what's happening around the city. And eventually, Ambrose helped him to realize certain things that he misunderstood about the Christian faith. He would become a Christian, partially through the preaching of Ambrose. So that's the background behind that. What Augustine's meaning is I'm going because I'm ambitious. But you, God, you were sending me so I'd meet, you knew what was going to happen, and you sent me there so I would meet Ambrose. It's not that Augustine is that God thinks, and this is he's playing off of Paul here and Paul's theology in the epistles. He's not saying that God gives you ungodly desires. Does that make sense? But since Genesis 3 happened and the human will has been broken, you have them. All of us have them, and I'm pointing at me, just us. And God uses those to his own ends. He's not the source of those desires, but they are there, and he will use them. Does that make sense? And without giving you like a three-week theology course, it'd be hard to give you much. It's a hyper-complex interpretation of all these things, but it's a great way of thinking of God's providence. So we shouldn't be surprised that Artaxerxes isn't thinking about godliness in any way, isn't thinking about anything of God, and yet God is using that through there for him. All right. I might have to skip this so we can get done in time. All right. Skip the next thing. All right. Okay. Next thing to remember, not Augustine. Nehemiah's bravery plus God's favor, because I don't want it to make it about just his bravery, or else we might think, if I'm brave, I will get what I want, and you will not. Right? What's the line between courage and foolishness? Right? It's an interesting conversation. When is your courage, and when is your courage foolishness? And you're like, ooh, I'm not sure when. So Nehemiah here, he was sad in the presence of the king, which Ed pointed out for us is not usually a good idea. Usually someone, especially someone like a cupbearer, could expect an undesirable result from being sad in the king's presence. But God gave Nehemiah favor in the king's eyes, and thus he was granted leave and letters. Don't forget the letters. Why would the letters be important? Because if you don't have the letters, the governors along the way are like, why are you here? You know, they could kill you, they could put you in jail, they could do whatever, but the letters give you, right, the cover to go do the thing. So he gets leave and letters to go to Jerusalem. Okay, then we met, although I don't remember if we spent much time on them. I spent a lot of time in the last few weeks looking into these guys because I was like, who in the world are these guys? I'm not going to give you all the stuff I found. We're just going to give you a couple things. Everybody just got really scared there. All right. Chapter 2, verse 10. We meet Sanballat the Horonite. Anybody know what a Horonite is? No, neither do the scholars. Okay. But here's our best guess. This is probably... Okay, a couple things about Sanballat. First, his name is Babylonian. It means it's Sin-Ubalit. I'm probably mispronouncing that. That's the best I can do. I'm not sure what that little thing under the T does to that, but because I don't study that language. But it means sin, not Christian sin, but sin, the moon god, gives life. So sin gives life. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that he worshipped the Babylonian gods. If you read Ezra, Zerubbabel is someone who, you know, follows God's call and has a very Babylonian name. But... So it doesn't necessarily tell us more than that. It just tells us that's his name. So he's Babylonian in some way, or at least his parents wanted him to have a Babylonian name. The names, now this isn't in the Bible, but there are some extra biblical texts from around this time that record who he was. And they tell us that he gave his children names that suggest he might have thought of himself as an adherent to the Israelite religion, which makes him even more complex as a character in this story. He gave his children the names Deleah and Shelemiah and Deleah, right? That sounds a little bit more like what you were used to hearing from the Bible, from the Old Testament at least. So Sanballat was eventually governor of Samaria, which was a pretty large area in that around there. He might have been governor at this point, but most scholars are divided on this, and most think it's a little early for him to have been governor of Samaria yet. So, the Horonite. We're not sure what the Horonite means. It might mean, and this is the most interesting option, in to say something is like, just we're not sure. But this is an interesting option, and this is like one that looked like it's maybe the most reasonable based on the little bit of evidence we have. There is a city in Moab, not Utah, but ancient Moab, named Horonaim. So it might have meant that he was from Horonaim, That might be why he's a the Horonite. If so, this would make him a Moabite. Okay. Who is excluded from the assembly of God. Let's look at Nehemiah 13:1. On the day they read from the book of Moses in the hearing of the people, or on that day, and it was found written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever enter the assembly of God. So he might have been a Moabite. That's one way in which this might be interesting. But the Ammonite, have you guys seen the AI? I should have put this up here, up there. That was a miss. Oh, have y'all seen the funny? Somebody entered into AI, draw King David defeating the Ammonites. Have you seen, any of y'all seen that? And it's David, like AI is like a seventh grade assistant that takes everything that you say too literally right now. And it's David standing and it's all the, you know what Ammonites are? They're like shellfish from the, in the biology or the zoology world. It's like giant shellfish fighting and like there's this battle going on between all these ancient Hebrews. And anyways, I'll see if I can find it later and put it up if we have. Just on the Ammonites. That's a little side note there. But so there, if he's a Moabite, he's technically, once they reestablish things, he's not supposed to be part of the assembly of God here, okay? If he's a Moabite also, this makes some more really interesting connections here. Now, Nehemiah 13:1 here, all they're doing really is rehashing or going over again, probably reading from Deuteronomy 23:3-5. No Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of the Lord. Even to the 10th generation, none of them may enter the assembly of the Lord forever because they did not meet you with bread and with water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam the son of Beor from Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse you. Okay. Notice why. Why do the Moabites not get to do that? Now, if you're an ancient Hebrew who, or an ancient Israelite who had just been raised on the first five books of the Old Testament, again and again and again, this might be in the back of your head if he is, and the word Horonite might say, oh, he's a Moabite, and might remind you of this, and it might be drawing some parallels for you. So again, these are all, did you hear how many qualifiers I put in there? He might. So it might mean this. This might be a parallel here if the title of the Horonite makes Sanballat a Moabite. When the Israelites returned from their exile in Egypt, they were met with animosity by the Ammonites and the Moabites, right? In the same way, Nehemiah might represent Israel returning from the Babylonian exile, right? Not Egypt, but Babylon being their Egypt, and being met with animosity by the second guy we haven't met yet, Tobiah, who is an Ammonite, and Sanballat, who could be the Moabite. Could be a parallel. God often writes into history parallel things that happened from beforehand. They'll happen again. So it's been a nice insight, and it fits the type of typology that we tend to get in Scripture with when the Spirit writes for us. But again, we're not sure. We're just not sure. So that was a long side note on that. All right, so the second guy of the three antagonists, Tobiah the Ammonite servant. He's also in 2:10. We're unsure of Tobiah's position. Some scholars think he's the governor of Ammon, right? Which would make he's an Ammonite, just that region. Others think he's a junior colleague of Sanballat. The third one we meet is Geshem the Arab in chapter 2, verse 19. And Geshem the Arab seems to have been a monarch with fairly widespread power. Now, how do we know this? His name's been found inscribed on a silver vessel dedicated by his son to the goddess Han Ilat in Lower Egypt. Now, Lower Egypt, you have to remember, is Northern Egypt because it's lower geographically. The river flows north. The Nile flows north. And there is a probable reference to him in Dayton. It's a kingdom located in the northwestern portion of the Arabian Peninsula, so he seemed to have a pretty broad regional influence in some way in his time. The other thing I always want to bring up here is Geshem the Arab. People groups back then are not people groups today. Does that make sense? I have a really bad made-up German last name, Grunwaller, and it's misspelled and everything. I'm about as German as I don't know. I'm about as German as I would be Russian. Like at one point in time, people groups move over history and they shift and they move. So whenever people do like DNA stuff and they have the DNA things, they're like, oh, I'm 3% this and 28% this. I'm like, that's interesting, but they're not telling you when, because the people that live like in Northern England in 500 BC is a totally different group of people than the people that live there in 500 AD. And then it changes. You get another 500 years, it changes again. People move, they shift, and you can't track them over world history. So we're all like weird mixes of a bunch of stuff, and it's hard because history moves to ever say, when am I from what? So what I'm not trying to say is like, I'm not trying to destroy whatever heritage you have. Like, there are connections, there's just no pure connections. Does that make sense? And so when you get into the 1800s, 1900s, when they're trying to get pure connections, that becomes hard. So this is not really a great connection to today in terms of him being the Arab. He's just, it sounds like at least at some point he has some influence in the Arabian Peninsula. We don't know what that means. He looks like or sounds like or talks like or is like. But those are the three people that we meet. All right. So let's move on to Nehemiah's process. We've touched on this a bit, but I want to kind of notice this for us, and then we're going to move on to chapter 3. We will make it. What time is it? Oh, 9. Okay. We're going to move a little fast here. You ready? Okay. Nehemiah's 900-mile journey from Babylon to Jerusalem could have taken him up to 4 months to arrive. That's calculating it at about 9 miles a day, which was typical for a caravan. Along the way, he gave the king's letters to the governors of the province beyond the river. So that's chapter 2, verse 9. One of the scholars we read, Williamson, or that I read, he thinks this section represents what he calls a dischronologized narrative. Again, that's dischronologized, which is a typical thing the Old Testament will do in order to emphasize a narrative effect. So it's a common literary device in Old Testament books. So we see it at the beginning of chapter 2, being used here in the way that we are not given an order of the presentation of the letters. We're not given any sense of how many governors he met along the way. We're not given a sense of the order in which they were met, etc. In fact, the way you read it, if you read it too quickly, you might just think he must have just shown up in Jerusalem and then given some letters and gone straight to Jerusalem, right? Or maybe the people are in Jerusalem, but it's probably about a verse that just gives you a long stretch of time in there. We're going to see dischronologized narrative next week even more because in book 3, we get a rebuilding of the wall narrative, all right? And we're going to tell us how the wall was rebuilt, and then it ends with it kind of like, and that's how we did it. And then in book 4, it's going to go backward and tell you stories about what happened as they rebuilt the wall. So if I don't call it the fancy word dischronologized narrative, and I just say, well, sometimes someone's going to give you an overview, and they're going to come back and give you specifics along the way. That's like, why do scholars make fancy words? I don't know. Just want to sound smart, I guess. But that's an example of a dischronologized narrative. And so when you're reading any book, you have to remember, you know, that an author might do that. It might go forward, it might jump backward, it might jump to the middle, it might start you in the middle and then go backward and forward, it might jump all over. And so we get that in here. So he gets there, he returns. Then we need to notice his modus operandi, his MO, right? His mode of operating when he arrives. Okay, quick question. Did he immediately tell everyone when he arrived in Jerusalem what he was there to do? Oh, good. Ed traded us well on that. No. Upon arising in Jerusalem, Nehemiah did what he did was he rested for 3 days. That's interesting that he rested for 3 days, isn't it? What else? Who else did things for 3 days? Jesus in the grave for 3 days. Can we think of anything else with 3 days? Jonah's in the whale, belly of the whale for 3 days. Anything else we can think of for 3 days? Was Lazarus down for 3 days? This is where I'm a theology professor, not a biblical studies professor. I should know this. Okay. 4 days? Lazarus was 4 days? Abraham's travel to Moriah took 3 days. Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting. Alrighty. Note this. Nehemiah 2:11. So I went to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Right? He rested there for 3 days before he starts doing anything. Notice Ezra, book 8, 32. We came to Jerusalem, and there we remained 3 days. The next verse for that one is, on the fourth day, we... And then they start doing things. See some parallels between Ezra and Nehemiah also? Yeah. Okay. So, next question. But when he gathered everyone together to show... But then, after these 3 days, then did he gather everyone together, show strong leadership, get up confidently, proclaim what he had seen, and go forward? No, he is not a CEO. Sometimes the American concept of strong leadership and a CEO is actually not the biblical concept. And we have to be careful, because in whatever culture you grew up in, you can't help but be in your culture. Things from your culture can seep in, and all of a sudden you assume they're in the Bible and they're not. Make sense? Now, there are times to show strong leadership. And I'm not saying that being a CEO is bad, and I'm not saying that showing strong leadership is bad. It's just not always. So he doesn't do this. He goes out at night to inspect the walls and gain firsthand knowledge of the situation. Why night? Oh, that's a good question. Why night? Well, probably, and again, scholars are guessing on this. But upon arriving in Jerusalem, why night? It might have been a clever move. Sanballat and Tobiah probably had supporters, right? People don't just exist by themselves in the world. Probably had strong supporters in the city. And he probably doesn't know how dire the situation is, or good, or big, or how many people there are. So he's probably trying to get as fast of a start as he can with as few hurdles as he has to jump over, at first at least. And so going out by night would allow him, it's just less people are likely to be there and get in your way. That's one idea. Could be some other things. Alrighty, but then he gathers them all together and tells them the plan. Right? This is a sort of, right? Like, sort of. No indication's given to how much time there was between his nocturnal inspection of the wall and chapter 2, verse 17, which begins, "Then I said to them." So we don't know how long this "then" implies. Nehemiah also approaches the people as one of them. He uses "we" a lot. And he appeals to an interpretation that they might all have regarding the state of the walls in 2:17. He says, "You see the trouble we're in. Quote, come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision." And only then does he tell them of the vision that God had given him and of the king's words to him. Of course, what's more important to him is the vision that God's given to him. So by doing so, he invites them to participate in God's call, and they make a decision in 2 verses 18b, where it says, quote, "And they said, let us rise up and build." Notice that? I always think this is funny. I'm like, he's the ultimate, that advice you get where you're like, hey, make them think it's their idea. You guys know that, right? Like, that's the ultimate salesman, makes them think it's their idea. I'm not sure if he meant to do that or not, so I don't know if I should read it that way or not, but he does it either way. Then as they began rebuilding the walls, Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem all threatened Nehemiah that the work carries the charge of, quote, do y'all remember what the charge was they brought against him? Rebelling against the king. Okay, this is really important to hit right here. This would not have been an empty charge. This probably would have caused anyone's listening's bellies to go a little bit, you know, get that weird pit in your stomach feeling. Nehemiah and others would have remembered something when they said that, for it was the same charge, it was the charge of rebellion against the king that was made by opponents of Ezra. Remember, Ezra's only a bit before Nehemiah gets there. It was in Ezra chapter 4, they write to the king and they say, if they rebuild the walls, they are rebelling against you, they're going to do this, they're going to do this. They're writing to Artaxerxes, remember Artaxerxes? Same king. And what does Artaxerxes write back? Well, that's not good. Stop it. And so, right, and when the king says stop it, it implies by choice or by force. And so it might have been by force that they would have done that. So the previous attempt to rebuild the walls were stopped because of this very same charge. So Nehemiah's response here, though, is interesting because he neither takes the bait nor does he debate with them. It says in 2:20, "Then I replied to them, the God of heaven will make us prosper, and we his servants will arise and build, but you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem. Okay. We're now to chapter 3, but we need what we call a brain break. Everybody pull out your phones. We're going to play a Kahoot. Anybody played a Kahoot before? Yes? Who's played a Kahoot before? All right, here we go. By the way, my computer is going to make noise. So I don't know if it's set up to make noise or not, but it. I think I can turn it up or down from here. Okay, here we go. We're going to go classic mode. It's everyone against everyone. There are no prizes, unfortunately. I apologize for that. What you need to do is... Oh, let's make this full screen. Oh, bottom right. Thank you. I'm trying to look at the screen from over here. There we go. Bottom right. Okay. So, oh, it's making sound up here. I wonder if I can change my sound to y'all's sound system. I don't know if it'll do it or not. Anyways, when you're, oh, right, I have to tell my middle and high school kids this. Write a perimeter appropriate name for yourself in there. So you need to put in, what you do is you go to kahoot.it, www.kahoot.it on your phone. If you don't have a phone, you can play with the person next to you, and you can play on their phone. Or you can enter the QR code by using your camera, and it'll take you directly to that website. So you open up Safari or Chrome on your phone, or if you have an iPad, John Boy, very nice. Who goes by John Boy? Bob, very good. You can also change while you're waiting for us what you appear as. Oh, BLJ, very good. Once you're in on this, I don't know how to get the sound to work. It's a little more fun with the sound. Oh, no, I accidentally hit Siri. No, Siri. Okay. Oh, wait, this might work. Are y'all getting sound now for us? No, you're not getting any sound back there? Okay. Let's see here. Oh, yeah, we are. There's our sound. Okay, we got it. Okay, are we waiting on anybody else? Oh, everybody's going to watch everyone else play? Oh, no. Sure, you want to play? Okay. Here we go. Ready? You can hold it over the people next to you if you know these answers. So what it's going to do is on the screen, it's going to show you the question and it's going to show you the answers. And on your phone, it's going to show you four options. Well, two options for true or false, four options for things you can choose. And what you do is you you hit the button of the ones that you think are correct. Ready? Here we go. Oh, all right. Question one. This is a silly one just to start us. Okay, 3, 2, 1. How do you spell my last name? You get points for getting correct answers. You also get points for getting answers more quickly. So, okay, we're waiting for all of our responses. There we go. Oh, there you go. Oh, very good. Good job. Nobody chose the yellow answer. Okay. Somebody might choose that. Wait, where's X-Tex? Who's X-Tex in first place? Oh, nice. Very nice. All right. True or false? Artaxerxes was the king whom Nehemiah served under. True or false? Okay. A little faster for time. Okay, Artaxerxes was the king. Yes, he was. That's true. Is X-Tex? Oh, we got some new people on the leaderboard. Very nice. Okay, next quiz. What building was constructed around the same time that Nehemiah was doing his work in Jerusalem? Was it Mercedes-Benz Stadium, the Pyramid of Giza, the Forum just down the road, or the Parthenon? Oh, everyone got that correct. Oh, way to go, everybody. Good job. Whoa, DR is on fire. Wait, who's DR now? Oh, okay, we're up in front. We're moving up. All right. Oh, puzzle. Okay, this is worth double points. Put these events in order. Here we are. The king, oh, that's kind of small. Sorry, make that typing bug. Red says the king asks Nehemiah why he's sad. Blue says Nehemiah is sad in the king's presence. Yellow says Nehemiah prays for several months. And green says the king grants Nehemiah leave and letters to travel to Jerusalem. Okay, there's more after this, but we're going to have to make this the last question so I can finish up some stuff. So, I have, is that correct, Travis? 4 minutes? Okay, 4 minutes. Okay. Alrighty. Let's see, okay, one group's still working on theirs. All right, here's the correct ones. Okay, so that's the correct order. Oh, whoa, one person got it totally right. Okay. Did I write that wrong? Is there a way you could argue for one of those to be in a different order? That one was hard. Yeah, it's okay. These are the hardest ones usually, is putting them in order. All right, we'll have to see who ended in first place. Oh, Cora. Where's Cora at? Oh, everyone, yeah, let's give great job. Okay, we're going to have to end it there. Cora's in first place. Well done, Cora. Well done. Okay. That's our little game for today. Okay, well, we had about five more, but I wrote too many questions, so... all right, so let's just do one last thing that I want us to end on, and that is actually do something from chapter 3. See, now I'm, let's see here. There we go. Okay. So, two things, and I'm just going to show you this, and then we'll move past it. One is, we're not sure of everything, but in chapter 3, what it does is it describes the rebuilding of the walls and the sections that were done by different folks. If you look in the north right, the north eastern part, the sheep gate there, it starts at the sheep gate and moves left, and chapter 3 goes counterclockwise all the way around to verse 32, which is the last verse, and it ends back at the sheep gate. It's a list of names, which is good because it grounds us in history. As we talked about last week, it reminds us of the things in history, but there's one verse that I want us to focus on. I had seen this verse before, but never realized that I had seen it before. Do you ever have that happen when you read the Bible and you're like, I don't remember that being there? It tells you who's rebuilding each section of the wall, and then in verse 5 it says, and next to them the Tekoites, I guess it would say, repaired, but their nobles would not stoop to serve the Lord.
I don't remember that.
I'd never seen that. here's what H.G.M. Williamson says about this. I think his words are pretty good. He says, I'll read this out for us because I know that's a little small. No reason is given for the unwillingness of the leaders of the Tekoites to serve. The form of expression used, however, is indicative of a resentment against the new leadership. This is in no way surprising. The return of the exiles from Babylon at any time is bound to have caused tensions with those who had remained in the land, particularly in the manner of relationships with other inhabitants of the land. The location of Tekoa makes likely the influence of Geshem, for good or ill. The viewpoint of Ezra and Nehemiah is such that those tensions are often glossed over or presented in a rather different light. Here he cross-references the treatment of mixed marriages in Ezra. A verse such as the present one is thus a valuable reminder that sharp differences of opinion within the wider Jewish community were never far beneath the surface. Okay, what do we glean from this in the minute and a half we have left? Two applications. Application one. Even when following God's plan, opposition from within can, and I should probably just say will, arise. So we should expect it. So we, or at least I, tend to desire things the way they were in Genesis 2. Harmony. If God's in it and we're all working together, there's harmony. Is God in this? Yes. God is in what Nehemiah is doing. Is there disharmony within the people of God? Yes. And so it is right and good that I expect harmony, because I expect, and it's natural, because that's the way things were in Genesis 2, and that's the way things will be at the end. But we're in this middle ground right now, and it is not that way. We all have fallen wills, and so we need to expect that. What does he do? Nehemiah notes it for half a verse, And then he just keeps going. He doesn't dwell on it. Second thing, final application. Because the first one assumes we're following the authentic call of God. Second one is, and this is, I think, particularly for us, we need to constantly be wary of how our relationships and the structures within which we live are forming us, might be forming us, or maybe in this sense might be deforming us, in such a way that when we are presented with an authentic call to God's plan from a leader in our community, we mistake our opposition to it as righteousness. Because I'm sure they thought they were doing the right thing. We're not noble women. We're not noble men. Maybe someone in here is. I'm not. But we do live the way noble men and noble women do in our geographic and chronological place in history. We have access to things. We're in a democracy. We have political power in that sense. We have a lot of money, right? We have a lot of things compared to generations that came before us from 5,000 years, 2,000 years, 1,000 years. Having all this stuff can make it even more difficult for us because change often implies losing something. Not just implies it, but often means it. And they saw change coming, and their fear of the future and not wanting to lose it kept them from participating in what God's plan was, and probably caused them to think that they were doing the righteous and good thing. So A, application one, right? We need to stick with it. We need to expect stuff, but then we stick with it. Two, if it is God's plan, we need to recognize that our nervousness over it might not imply that it is bad, but might just be a result of where we live and how we live and how that's formed us. Alrighty, I think I need to break, and we've got something else coming up. Thank you so much, everyone. I'm so sorry we didn't have time for questions. Thanks for having me again. I hope you have a great time.
Okay. We also have the pleasure of having David Riddle with us this morning. And he's going to talk to us about an opportunity for a GO Journey to France. And so, David, it's all yours.
Of course, I can't see it on my screen, but that doesn't matter. Good morning. Yes, people... My grandfather changed my name from Riddle to Riddell. So because, you know, you don't want to be called David Riddle. I'm the international director of World Team, good friends, of course, of Kathy and Bob. And so I'm going to talk a little bit more about than just France. So it's really tough to follow on Brian there. I really appreciate those insights. That was so helpful. So I want to talk quickly about the world and then France. Okay, so Thomas Friedman wrote a famous landmark book called The World is Flat, and he was right. You do realize that the majority of Christians live in the Southern Hemisphere. I know this is a large crowd, but in the Southern Hemisphere, it would be 3, 4, 5 times the gal from Guatemala here. We could certainly attest to that, that there are many more believers now in the Southern Hemisphere than in the Northern Hemisphere, which means the large group of mission agencies and churches such as ours are still playing in the world of missions, but the small emerging mission movements realize they're playing on the same playing field as we. So you now have Filipinos who want to go to another part of the world. You have people from Latin America who want to go to Cameroon. You have Chinese believers wanting to serve in Cambodia alongside Japanese believers. So the world is completely changing, okay? It's the same level playing field. So this was a recent global conference that we held within our agency. We are not a large agency, but nonetheless, on the platform, you have an Indonesian believer, you have a gal from Vietnam, you have a fellow from the Philippines, and you have a fellow from Singapore. That's the world that we're living in right now. So we are all playing together. So the world is much more interdependent and collaborative. But at the same time, Fritz Kling, if you ever want to read a very interesting book, it's called The Meeting of the Waters, And he went around the world just to see what was happening. And one of the things he discovered was what we call monoculture. It's that veneer that seems to imply that we all speak the same language, American. By the way, you speak American, you don't speak English. I learned that very quickly in France when I worked with UK people. No, you don't speak English. But we all believe that we do, and we speak the same language. But underneath that veneer is a whole host of ways of doing things that are different. So, for example, if I say AFL, anybody a football, American football fan here? Do you know what AFL is? Yep, but that's not what an Australian understands. An Australian hears AFL and they think Australian Football League, which is Australian rules. And if you want to watch something really crazy, watch an Australian rules football match. Okay, so this is all just to say that's some of the difficulty that we all face. Because you walk into a room with an Australian and you think you're talking the same language and understanding things the same way, but you're not. We say, I want to table that idea, right? And that means what? We're going to put it off and deal with it another time. When you say table something in Australian English, it means we're going to talk about it now. So you imagine the difficulty when you're sitting in a meeting and all of a sudden they say, let's table that, and the Australian says, okay, ready to talk. So the world is changing, and that's what a church planter has to do. They have to understand that world, they have to work within that world, and they have to figure out how to contextualize the message so that people will understand. When we do communion, we use bread and wine. Jesus is the bread of life. In Indonesian culture, there is no such word for bread. Bread is not a staple. It does not exist. So what do you say when you hold communion? The only thing, the thing that the church planters there discovered was sweet potato. Because sweet potato is the same staple and item as a loaf of bread. So whether you feel comfortable with it, they have communion and they talk about Jesus being the sweet potato of life. Because that's what they want. That's what they understand. That's what a church planner has to do. Okay, now to France. That's what I was asked to say. And sorry, I know we had some really good pastries over here, but if any of you have been to France, yes, it goes to a whole new level. All right, there's three important facts that you need to know. One is what we call the CNEF. That's the National Council of French Evangelicals. If you want to hear it in French, it's Conseil National des Évangéliques de France. And that was a group that came together about 15 years ago, and the basic thing you need to understand is it destroyed all the obstacles that kept people from working together. In simple terms, layman, laywoman terms, we were in turf warfare. You were working over there, and you wouldn't dare let me come and work in the same town as you did, because you're church planting here, and you've got it covered. The CNEF opened the whole door and allowed people to begin working together towards one goal, which is one church for every 10,000 people. Now, there is currently one church for every 35,000 people. So you can see the work that has to be done. However, I've had many, many people question this statistic, but this is a real statistical piece of data that there is a new church plant started in France every 10 days. Now that does not mean, this is what Brian said, the mite, right? This does not mean that church plant becomes a mature church. But that's the kind of traction that got started with the CNEF. You break down the barriers, now people start to work together, and you create this dynamic so that there are all these churches getting launched. Third thing is, you may have heard about the new government legislation. I'm not going to go into all the details because the French invented the word administration. So don't tell me that you think American administration is difficult. Just come and we'll give you a couple of, days and you'll see how complicated it can be. But basically every church, for put it in our language, has to reincorporate themselves every 5 years. Now some of you, you don't even know what that is. Some of you have been involved in that. You know the paperwork. That's a lot of work to put on churches that are primarily 50 to 100 people. We also cannot receive more than 10,000 euros from funding outside of France. We can receive it, but we have to do double accounting. So you keep two record books, and then they will look at that one which says, oh, Perimeter gave, you know, X amount of money to this ministry. We better look into that because they're worried about all the movements, terrorist movements within Europe. So it is difficult. However, that is not creating a problem for the local churches. You know, when you're in the midst of things that are difficult, it tends to push you to help one another. So yes, it is difficult, but no, it is not slowing the effort of people to see churches started. So you may be interested to say, well, so where do you fit into all this, David and my wife, Rebecca? We serve in a local French church, so I am one of the elders. We have a young pastor that we've hired, and that's a whole story in itself. But we have about 75 to 80 members. That's a fair size church. We are, because of the new legislation, we're required to only have 50 people in the room at a time. So the room we rent, they took away all our chairs and only give us 50, and we have to deal with that. That's okay. But the church continues to see new people. We mentor and coach several pastors and church planters. That's both French as well as expats. We have trained 30-plus young emerging leaders within our agency. That's our goal, is to build the base of leadership for the next generation, and that includes people from all different cultures. We had a global conference, first time we ever brought all of our people together, over 300 of our workers, staff, board members, and we platformed 35 of our young emerging leaders at that. We also launched what we call coach training. It's how to help people move along a process in doing the work that they're doing, and we've trained 95% of our leaders in that. I know you have a Go Impact, a Go France project, and that is certainly something worthy for you to consider. I'll just throw another one at you for fun. We call it the E3 project, and we're launching 8 new initiatives. That means multiple church plants among the group of unreached. We're going to, one of our KPIs, if you are familiar with that, so you know your key performance indicator, is to train 20 more young emerging leaders in order to lead those. So if you want to know more about that, you can contact me at that address, international.director@worldteam.org. That's all I have to say. I know it's quick, but just remember the world is changing constantly. And we're so grateful for your willingness to allow me to just share some of that, and hopefully that will pique your interest in a number of books and other ideas that are out there. So there you have it.
Thank you, David. Let me close this in prayer. Dear Father, we thank you for this morning. Lord, this is very insightful and very encouraging on both sides. We ask you to be with David and particularly all the ministries that he's dealing with. That we pray for the people of France. We pray that there be a great work take place there. In Christ's name we ask. Amen.